Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you. Today, we're going to learn a lot about human nature. I'm not going to do a long introduction because I want to spend more time with our guest, Sasha Brensky, from Northern California, talking about the triumph and dominance of fear in America and the long-term consequences to making choices from fear. You won't want to miss that. He is a wonderful journalist. He's a graduate of Oxford University, Columbia University's senior fellow, specializing in inequality, poverty, and incarceration in the criminal justice system. So we're going to take all this on. Then I'm going to share, in alignment with this, an audio clip that I found of George Carlin talking about a war on homelessness. And then I'm going to start a series of what I'm looking at, what can we learn from all of feminism. Now, there's some important messages, some constructive, some destructive, positive and negative. Today, we're going to learn something from Camilla Peglia. She's urging feminists to stop blaming men for their discontent. Whoa, that'll get some tempers going. But before we react, let us reason. I believe in listening to what someone has to say, then making my judgments upon what I hear, the context that I hear, and what the implications could be. I do not believe in censorship. So, we're going to start with her. And then I'm also going to today give you the names of people that I intend to have on this program that you have not heard from. Now, these are all feminists, but they are what I call spiritual feminists. They have been excluded. Not only has the door been shut on them, but they frequently have been dismissed as irrelevant or not ideological, not hard enough, not demeaning enough against men. Well, how exactly has that war turned out? So this is the beginning of a whole new series, and tomorrow, I was going to play it the other day, did not have time, will be a debate between Arianna Huffington and Paglia, that will be on tomorrow's show. And then what can we learn from that debate? We have to listen to it first. Don't take sides. Remember, you can agree or disagree with any part or whole what someone shares with you. We're also going to do the same thing with our educational system. I am intending to go into the hearts and minds of those who are controlling the American dialogue, making everything politically correct. Well, how do you think that's going to turn out? So we're going to take a look at it, and we're going to start today with Professor Jordan Peterson, Why You Won't Have a Career. Really? Okay, maybe right. We'll listen, then we'll make our minds up. On all these issues later in the program, I'll be opening it up, if time permits, for your feedback. Let's go now where we're going to begin with the latest on health and healing, as we do each day here. There's a study from the University of Haifa in Israel that talked about how consuming red meat, as well as processed meat, that would be like a hamburger, a steak, a pork chop, versus salami, bologna, pastrami, and how they're linked to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, as well as insulin resistance. Now, here's what we can tell you. The world meat consumption has increased during the last several decades, and evidence is mounting that high consumption of red and mainly processed meat, what you get on your pizzas, is unhealthy in the extreme to humans, and it's related to chronic diseases like cancer, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. The study was published in the Journal of Hepatology, and it adds non-alcoholic fatty liver disease to the list. Quote, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is considered as the hepatic, that's your liver, component of the metabolic syndrome, with insulin resistance and inflammation as key factors in its pathology. That's according to the professor here. But let's pull back for a moment and say, why does this matter? Well, this is where you have to detach from any single part of it and look at all the pieces. In other words, bring each piece of the puzzle on health together. For example, right now the restaurants that are the most popular are the ones that generally have the largest servings. We're not talking about a gourmet restaurant that serves you small portions. We're talking about the average restaurant that a person goes into. And a lot of this was because of what some of the food programs on television were showing as huge quantities of food, whatever the food was, that you would consume at a given sitting. What no one took into account was not whether people enjoyed the taste. They did. That it was a part of some of their tradition, frequently is, and that it filled them up. Oh, it did more than that. But what does your body need in the food that you just ate? And what will it do? And when you came to refined carbohydrates, meaning the simple sugars, there goes obesity and diabetes and heart disease. And if it's a meat, there increases your breast cancer, prostate cancer, dementia, because these are pro-inflammatories, meaning every time you eat something like a hamburger, you got the bun and you got the meat. Well, those are both pro-inflammatories, and they're not easy to digest. But also it's giving you far more carbohydrate than what the body needs as far as calories, and it gives you a lot more protein. And when you get that excess protein, there goes your kidneys, and there goes your liver. Now, today we're learning that includes non-fatty alcoholic liver disease. So that's why it's bad. In preparing a new documentary that I'm working on now and filming and will be premiering around the United States, probably early summer, probably in June, I've had an opportunity to look at the entire body of scientific literature throughout the world. And the conclusion from the vast, vast consensus of science in all countries is that the more animal proteins you consume, the more disease you create. In fact, I could not find a single article in all of the hundreds of thousands of articles in scientific literature was that when you eat a steak, you're healthier. It's good for your cells. It's good for your DNA. It doesn't exist. But I found thousands of studies, and I actually took the time to get all these studies and photograph the jacket of every single one of these, covers of every one of these, showing the abstracts, showing that you're going to raise your blood pressure level, you're going to have more problems with itises, etc. Now, so when someone comes into my office and they're presenting with multiple symptoms, including dementia or multiple sclerosis, and I start going through not just their diet, I go through their entire life history. That's why it takes several hours. And then I start seeing all this meat that they're consuming, animal proteins, and right there, that's a big red flag, because you get rid of that. You get rid of the mercury fillings. You get rid of the bad bacteria. You get rid of the antibiotics. You start rebuilding the intestine, rebuilding the brain cells, rebuilding the dendrites. So in effect, you have to tear down what is rotted in that old building and repair it and rebuild it with everything new. And if any of you ever have bought a place and fixed it up, you know how serious it is. You don't replace rotted wood with rotted wood. And yet somehow we feel that none of this is important. None of it's relevant. After all, we have our lifestyles. We have our comforts. We have our limits and constraints. At a certain point, people will not change. They simply won't, the vast majority. So then we have adapted to their constraints. So no matter what level of your game, you got to bring your game down to everyone else's game of how they think, how they behave, how they believe, how they feel. Wonder what could go wrong there. Let me just think. You know what goes wrong because everyone listening right now has had situations in your life where you've wanted something better for someone, something that would have helped them. Trouble is they weren't willing to engage as much on their own behalf as you were trying to help them from your standard. So what do? Lower your standard? That's like giving a clean needle to a heroin addict. it doesn't change the outcome. Giving a 60% alcohol instead of 80 to an alcoholic. I just don't believe we think through things. I believe that we're not engaging in full cognitive understanding. So just listen carefully. The entirety of all science shows animal proteins are dangerous, but they're each one a different piece of the puzzle. You want mucus in your kid? Give him dairy. You want him bedwetting? Give him wheat. You want, and so it goes. So we've got to clean that out. And that study is confirming that. Music therapy aids healing of military personnel. Now, considering what an abysmal failure our entire Veterans Administration has been, and our government, the Pentagon, and all the warmongers, and Laura Ingraham, and Sean Hannity, and all the other people who on some issues are correct, and many of these people have the full capability of understanding a problem when it's in alignment with their ideology. But when it goes against their ideology, all that education, all that common sense reason go out the window, and they're just as dumb as a brick. You talk with these people, you hear what they're saying, and you're thinking, you're not suggesting we go in there and destroy Gaddafi. You're not suggesting Assad really used poison. Have you done your homework? Did you read the articles that show he didn't? No. You don't really believe that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, do you? You have the resource to do your homework? Now, both the left and the right are equally guilty in hubris and Machiavellian politics. That's why we need multiple parties. We need parties as they have in Europe from multiple different perspectives. Right now, the disease of our society is the politopathology of a two-party system, which is one is two controls it. In any case, when you look at the military-industrial complex, they will look at the consequences of a person having a condition in a veteran's hospital and they're not being treated, and that will outrage them. That touches something that bypasses their political denialism, and that is a human being suffered. Now, they're going to call that person a hero. I will not. I will look at what constitutes heroism first to determine, did you kill innocent men and women? Were you shot in the process? Then you're not a hero. So I also understand the mindset, since I've interviewed over 1,100 of these vets, and I want to help them. But I tell them to their face, I do not support your actions. I'm not here to argue those. I'm here to help you. But be clear about it. I can help a person without believing in them. Now, I've done that a lot of times, including Lawrence Burton. I'll mention his name. Normally, I don't mention people's names, but I have such disdain for that man. And on so many levels, but he did, to his credit, he cured people of cancer. I will not tell you the backstory, but I can tell you how difficult it is to support individuals because they're doing something good, even though I don't consider them a person that I would befriend, even if I save their career or make them famous, which is the case in Lawrence Burton. I'll go into that on another occasion because it shows you that frequently make the mistake of accepting everything. If someone does something good, they must be a good person. That doesn't always follow true. In any case, and both the left and the right are guilty of this situation of not asking a basic question. You have a man or a woman in a veteran's bed. They might have waited 3 years to get treated. Their life has been miserable. Maybe you've got one person who would think about putting a gun in their mouth and blowing their brains out today. There'll be 22 of them doing that. There won't be a single news story. There won't be a single young millennial outraged about that and marching against that. There won't be any group of people saying, yeah, let's do something to help prevent 22 deaths today and tomorrow and every day for the last 18 years. Back in a moment with George Carlin. George is going to tell us about homelessness in the way that only he could. And remember, George Carlin today, it'd be hard to find a college campus university that he'd be allowed to speak. because they wouldn't feel good. They'd have to, after they saw 5 minutes of George, they'd have to go to their psychologist, go into a room, hug pillows and baby dolls, and be breastfed from a special cow. That's the millennials. Back in a moment.
By the way, speaking of American values, aren't we about due to start bombing some small country that only has a marginally effective air force? Seems to me like we're a couple of weeks overdue to drop high explosives on helpless civilians. People who have no argument with us whatsoever. I think we ought to be out there doing what we do best, gang, making big holes in other people's countries. I hate to be repetitious, but God, we are a warlike lot, you know? We can't stand not to be with somebody. We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? Just couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over so we could go and play with our toys in the sand. Go play with our toys in the sand. And while we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. Do you ever notice that? We love to do that, don't we? We love to declare war on things here in America. Anything we don't like about ourselves. We have to declare war on it. Don't do anything about it. We just declare war on it. We got a war. It's the only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving a problem. It's called declaring a war. We got a war on poverty, the war on crime, war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice there's no war on homelessness, is there? Nah, no war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. There's no money in that problem. Nobody stands... True. Nobody stands to get rich off of that problem. You could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of $1 million each. You'd see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty goddamn quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that. Now, so... I got an idea for homeless. You know what they ought to do? Give the homeless their own magazine. Give them their own magazine. It would make them feel better, for one thing. That's a sure sign of making it in this country. Every group in this country that makes it and arrives at a certain level has its own magazine. You have Working Mother magazine, Black Entrepreneur magazine, Hispanic Business magazine. In fact, any activity engaged in by more than four people in this country is a magazine devoted to it. Skydiving, mountain climbing, snowmobiling, backpacking, bungee jumping, duck hunting, shooting someone in the dart gun. They probably have a magazine for that. I'm sure they have. I know they have a magazine. Walking! There's actually a magazine called Walking. Look, Dan, the new Walking is out. Here's a good article, putting one foot in front of the other. Give them their own magazine. Give them. Give the homeless their own magazine. You know what you call it? Better Crates and Cartons. Then when they get finished reading it, they can use it to line their clothing. That's a good sound business solution. That's the kind of answer you get from a conservative American businessman. Yeah, let them read it. When they get finished reading, they can use it to plug up the holes in them piano crates they all seem to like to live in. A good sound, practical, conservative American business solution. I'll tell you what they ought to do about homelessness. First thing, change the name of it. Change the name of the condition. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. It's houses these people need. A home is an abstract idea. A home is a setting. It's a state of mind. These people need houses. Physical, tangible structures. But where are you going to put them? Where are you going to build them? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country. You've heard of it. It's called NIMBY. N-I-M-B-Y.
Not in my backyard.
People don't want any kind of social help located anywhere near them. You try to open up a halfway house. Try to open up a rehab center for drugs or alcohol. Try to build a little home for some retarded people who want to work their way into the community. People say, not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them, especially if it might help somebody else. Part of the great American spirit of generosity we're always told about. Big, generous American nation. Ask an Indian about that. Ask an Indian how generous this country is. If you can find one, you got to locate the Indian first. We've made him just a little difficult to find. Or if you need current data, select a black family at random and ask them how generous this country has been. People don't want anything near them, even if it's something they believe in, something they think society needs, like prisons. Everybody wants that, right? Everybody wants more prisons. That's the new answer to all of our problems. Lock a lot of mother. Everybody wants more prisons. They say, build more prisons. But not here. But why not? What's wrong? What's the problem? What's wrong with having a prison in your neighborhood? Well, it seemed to me like it would make it a pretty crime-free area, don't you think? You think a lot of crackheads and muggers and pimps and hookers are going to be hanging around in front of a prison? Look, they ain't coming anywhere near it. What's wrong with these people? All the criminals are locked up behind the walls. And if a couple of them do break out, what do you think they're going to do? Hang around? Check real estate trends? Well, get gone! That's the whole idea of breaking out of prison, is to get as far away as you possibly can. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them. Except military bases. They don't mind that, do they? No, they like that. Give them an army base. Makes them happy. Why? Jobs. Jobs. Self-interest. Even if the base is loaded with nuclear weapons, they don't give a f-. They say, well, I'll take a little radiation if I can get a job. Working people have been over so long in this country, those are the kind of decisions they're left to make. I got just the place for low-cost housing. I have solved this problem. I know where we can build housing for the homeless. Golf courses. Perfect. Golf courses. Just what we need. Plenty of good land in nice neighborhoods. Land that is currently being wasted on a meaningless, mindless activity. Engaged in primarily by white, well-to-do male businessmen who use the game to get together to make deals to carve this country up a little finer among themselves. I am getting tired. Really tired. I am getting tired of these golfers in their green pants and their yellow pants and their orange pants and their precious little hats. And their cute little golf carts. It is time to reclaim the golf courses from the wealthy and turn them over to the homeless. Golf is an arrogant, elitist game, and it takes up entirely too much room in this country. Arrogant game on its very design alone. Just the design of the game speaks of arrogance. Think of how big a golf course is. The ball is that big. What do these pinheads need with all that land? There are over 17,000 golf courses in America. They average over 150 acres apiece. That's over 3 million acres. That's 4,820 square miles. You could build two Rhode Islands and a Delaware for the homeless on the land currently devoted to this meaningless, mindless, arrogant, elitist, racist. Racist. There's another thing. The only blacks you'll find in country clubs are carrying trays and a boring game. For boring people. Did you ever watch golf on television? It's like watching flies. And a mindless game. Mindless. Think of the intellect. Think of the intellect it must take to draw pleasure from this activity. Hitting a ball with a crooked stick and then walking after it.
Well, only he could put it in that perspective. Now, as a part of our new series on advocating for a new feminism, we're going to have some of the leading spokespersons from all different divisions of feminism. But here's who you haven't heard, but should. Here's who's been not up at the top of the list, but deserves to. Vandana Shiva. Now, you might know her because of her work as an anti-GMO and anti-nuclear activist, but she's a big women's activist in a big country with lots of women. And why should we care? Because in India, there's between, no one has the exact figures, but it's around 4 million babies a year are killed if they're female. Plus, there's over 22 million missing women in India, according to a report last week. So wouldn't you think that if you're really interested in women's rights and equality, that's a good country to spend some time in and to try to help the women in that country? Marianne Williamson, she's a wonderful spiritual teacher. I have a lot of respect for her. She was the founder of Meals on Wheels program and Project Angel Food and co-founded the Peace Alliance, pushing for the establishment of a U.S. Department of Peace with Dennis Kucinich. Charlene Spretnik, a retired professor of feminine theology, in my opinion, one of the first of the theatricians on economic feminism and co-founder of the American Green Party. Jean Bolin, Jungian psychiatrist and spiritual teacher in psychological feminist movements. Elizabeth Satoris, wonderful person, and I filmed her on two. She lives on an island outside of off the coast of Greece now. She is a big believer in Earth spirituality, which has a feminist orientation. Angel Toya Williams, an African-American Zen Roshi, she's a black feminist working in inner city communities such as Harlem to empower women. And the Reverend Sally Bingham, and Episcopal priest of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, founder of the Regeneration Project and Interfaith Power and Light campaign. She works in synagogues and mosques and churches, and she's an environmental activist. Lynn Twist, New Age personality, and she is a big believer in the indigenous women's rights and saving the rainforest. Joanna Macy, very important in the eco-Buddhist feminist movement, and she helps people understand the power of grieving. Joan Halifax, and she is certainly one of the pioneers in hospice care and death work. Joan Borisenko, in fact, I'll be filming her. I'm going to be filming in Northern California tomorrow and then up to Canada for this new film. And Joan, who's a medical doctor, along with Christina Northrup, both empower women in their spirituality, but through natural health means. And Karen Baker Fletcher, African-American eco-justice theologian and feminist, and co-sponsor of the Earth Ministry. And Reverend Jetsuma Palmo, a British Tibetan Buddhist nun working to educate tribal girls throughout the Himalayan region. And Annette Hoffman, chairman of the Women of the Wall, Israel's women's feminist group trying to bring gender equality to Judaism. And Winona LaDuc, a Native American ecofeminist activist and tribal elder. And we also have Sister Elizabeth McAllister, became Father Philip Berrigan's wife and peace and anti-Vietnam war activist, anti-nuclear activist, and a member of the Harrisburg Seven. And Sister Joan Chichester, chair of the Global Peace Initiative for Women to create a global network of feminist peace builders. And Sharon Salzberg, a Buddhist meditation teacher and eco-feminist, largely responsible for bringing mindfulness meditation to America. When you hear the word mindful meditation, it's because of this wonderful spiritual feminist, Sharon Salzberg. And Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, spiritual teacher at Bat Shemchat Torah, and known as the LGBT Synagogue. And Daisy Khan, founder of the Women's Islamic Initiative on Spirituality and Equality to empower Muslim girls and women. And Layli Miller Muro, head of the Justice Center, and works to protect women and girls from human rights abuses. And Starhawk, longtime leader of the ecofeminist and feminist neo-pagan movements. So you see, I believe that the entire feminist movement would benefit by having these voices who come from a very loving and spiritual and non-alienating position, and they've been excluded. Well, we're going to bring you those voices. Now here, before we go to our guest and some people on standing on call, here is Camille Paglia, a short piece. I think you'll find it interesting.
I'm noticing, everywhere I go, to speak, whether it's England, Italy, Brazil, where I've gone a number of times and so on, the upper middle class professional women are very unhappy. They're very unhappy. They may have power, they may have a nice lifestyle and so on, but there is the misery quotient is high, okay? And what I'm saying, okay, as a feminist, is that the women have to stop blaming men for their sense of malaise or misery, okay? It's not men. There's been a cultural change. An enormous change has happened, all right? For the first time in history, men and women are working side by side in an environment. So men and women are having more contact with each other than they ever did, okay? There used to be in the agrarian era, for all those tens of thousands of years, the world of men and the world of women. And those two worlds didn't come together that often. So I can still remember it, okay, in that end of the agrarian era that I experienced in childhood. Okay, the women had their own world. They ruled the private sphere, right? All day, it was multi-generational, okay? There was a solidarity that women had. They were in charge of tremendous amount of life. And the men, you would come together for dinner, okay? But, the men had their own world. And, I remember the men, when the men would come over to my grandmother's house, my grandfather would be sitting there. They would be drinking. I could smell the coffee with the anisette, they would put alongside of it, the smoking, et cetera. And the men, we would have the men, okay? And then the women had their own thing, okay? So I think that what women are feeling right now is a sense of displacement, okay, and loneliness, okay, because it's the collapse of the extended family, okay, the multi-generational family, into this nuclear family. It could be that this nuclear family thing is toxic, okay, all right? This thing of like a husband and a wife and children in a home in a nice house. It could be like a horrible prison. It could be like a crucible for Freudian neurosis, okay, and so on, okay? Yeah, so, never in history, okay, have you had this entrapment of the children with the parents, okay? The parents are now, now they're responsible for everything, okay? And then, the richer, the wealthier, okay, the more affluent, a wife and so on, who has children, okay, the less likely she is going to be able to rely on neighbors, okay, to like pitch in for her, okay, can you imagine Scarsdale, the wife or whatever, okay, something comes up, okay, she needs to run somewhere to do something, to say to her neighbor, okay, can you watch the kids for a couple of hours? Oh, sure, okay, that's really going to happen, okay, sometimes you hardly know the neighbors, okay, all right, so oddly enough, many working class neighborhoods, you have much more of an integration there and a familiarity because on the whole, working class people don't move, okay, as much. Okay, they often grow up in neighborhoods where they grew up. They know everybody, et cetera, right? And it's a feature even in South Philadelphia to this day. In those row houses in South Philadelphia, the Italian section and so on, people sit on the stoop, okay? They watch everything that goes by, okay? They're monitoring the way kids behave in the street, okay? There was a whole village quality, in the old village life, there was a sense of community and a sense of belonging, a sense of identity, and now today, people have to struggle. Young people have to struggle for an identity, okay? Have to struggle, okay? Everyone feels very displaced, right? Another thing, okay, is that at the higher up you go in terms of affluence, the less likely it is that you on vacations that you'll be vacationing with your relatives, okay, right? You know what I'm saying? In other words, people who are flying to St. Bart's, are not taking their parents, okay? They're not taking all the cousins and so on, right? But when I go to drive an hour, go to the New Jersey shore, okay, where working class families go in the Wildwoods and so on, you see multi-generational vacationing, okay? All the generations. You see the children running around, you see the parents, and you see the old people, they're sitting there in their chairs, like this and so on, the water's lapping their feet, and so on. I'm going, this is amazing. This is a capsule, okay, of what life used to be like, that contact among all the generations, okay? And the same thing in Philadelphia, the parks, like Fairmount Park and so on. And any Sunday, any weekend, you go there, and it's working-class families who are taking over the park benches and the barbecue pits and are spending the whole day there multi-generations, all together, free, okay, to go to the park, okay? Right? So that's why you're getting more and more neurosis the higher up you go in terms of affluence, okay? You know, that's why you have some of the most privileged young people, you know, in our society getting into the elite schools and, you know, having to take antidepressants and, you know, throwing themselves out of windows and everything else, okay? Because mere material affluence isn't enough, okay, you know, for identity. So actually, the stronger personalities seem to be coming from working class culture, you know, because they have a sense of their own, you know, place in the universe. Okay? They aren't being shipped around every place. All right. So I think there's a lot of psychological ills in the culture. But I'm calling for a moratorium on this anti-male stuff. Okay. All right. Feminism has gotten very contaminated with anti-male rhetoric. It's completely unnecessary. Okay. All the problems in the world are not due to men. Okay. A lot of problems are due to the systemic change that happened. Okay. In this new era that we belong to. All right. Well, I mean, we want to have questions, so I should stop. All right.
Okay.
Should I just stop?
That's her perspective. Listen carefully what she had to say and see if there's anything in her statements that seem reasonable, responsible, that allow us to carry on a more mature dialogue. And we'll be bringing other people and their points of view. They can be right or wrong in your mind, but don't judge someone till you hear what they have to say. And then take a moment. Go to that non-judgmental place in your psyche, in that mindful place, and then analyze it and see what we can learn from them. We're going now directly out to California to say hello to my guest, Sasha Abramski. I mentioned his background earlier, and he is also the author of several books, including Inside Obama's Brain, and separately, The American Way of Poverty, which was included on the New York Times 100 Notable Books of the Year. And his most recent is Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. His website is Sasha, S-A-S-H-A, Abramski, Abramsky.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, good morning.
I'd like to start this with a psychological conversation that examines the consequences of the self-produced feedback loops between individual fear in people and the collective fear that is shaping our culture. And although fear has been used in political campaigning for a long time, it was ramped up, especially during the Bush administration after 9/11. And fear-mongering has been a well-known tool of tyrannical and totalitarian governments. Fear is largely an emotional response induced by a perceived threat. And whether it is terrorist or a school shooter or a minority group, and I know from the medical literature that fear can change brain and organ function as well as behavior, it can lead to, let's say, to a place where we want to run and hide or freeze up, or very often there's a loss of courage and a willingness to surrender ourselves to those who we believe protect us, such as the government or certain political parties. And the more we fear something, the far scarier it becomes. And in your exploration of this subject, you've been studying how the U.S. has become a fear-based society. But then there are other things we should fear more about but don't. The threats of climate change come to mind because one study showed that although most people accept anthropogenic climate change and feel it will be adversely affecting other people, a minority of those same people didn't fear it would affect them. And yet they have more fear of a terrorist attack, which is far less likely than the effects of climate change or even the harm from medical treatment. So please take us through your research, take your time, and show us what happens when we irrationally adapt fears without first examining whether they're real and to what extent and what consequences they might have on us. The form is yours.
Okay, so the thing that fascinated me when I was doing research, not just for this book, but in reporting around the country over the last few years, is that we have sort of retreated into a series of echo chambers. So we're predisposed to fear certain things. We're predisposed as a culture to fear difference. We're predisposed to fear strangers. We're predisposed to fear the unknown. That's sort of evolutionary. We have emerged as a species, a very successful, adaptable species, at least in part because we have a very finely honed survival instinct. Now, survival instincts which result in flight, fight, or freeze responses are very, very good in a state of nature. So let's say you're a primitive man and you're trying to survive in a dog-eat-dog world. You're trying to survive in a world where there are saber-toothed tigers and other animals out to kill you. Well, if you live in a cave and a saber-toothed tiger approaches you, unless you respond with split-second speed, you're dead. So evolutionarily, the fear mechanisms in our brain were fine-tuned to respond at speed to that kind of danger. We still have that. If you fast forward today, you're walking in the forest and you see an object in front of you that looks like a snake. Your body changes in a split second. Your heart races, your blood pressure goes up, your muscles tense. Adrenaline surges through your body, a whole bunch of other chemicals are released that prime you to respond to a natural danger. And you do that unconsciously. You do it before the conscious you is aware of what's happening. And then the conscious you kicks in and you slow down and you realize that it was just a stick. It wasn't a snake at all. It was a stick. And so you try and calm yourself down. And you can eventually, but for a few minutes anyway, your heart's still going to be beating fast. Your adrenaline's still going to be surging. Your body is in that state of panic. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is we respond very similarly in a high-tech world to high-tech fears. So we don't just kick in the adrenaline and the cortisol and all these other chemicals in response to natural fears. We also kick them in response to, let's say, terrorism or crime or violence that we see on television or social media postings about kidnappings or plane accidents or strange animal attacks, whatever it might be. And the problem with that is we don't calculate probability. So once our fear instincts kick in, once our body starts adapting to this sense of risk is present, our ability to calculate the likelihood of something happening goes down. Now, the relevance that that has for our political moment, if you have a demagogic political leader or political leadership willing to exploit fears and willing to exploit fears with no limits, really bad things can happen in the political system, especially when they're amplified by social media. So if you take what happened in 2016 with the election of Trump, you had a presidential candidate who was willing and able to exploit fears on terrorism, to exploit fears on gender identity, to exploit fears on race relations, to exploit fears on immigration, even to exploit fears on climate change being a hoax. He infamously said that climate change was a Chinese hoax. He said that vaccinations were a hoax perpetuated by the medical community. When you have somebody willing to sort of use laser targeting of people's fears and insecurities, you have the ability to change the political system very profoundly, because in a state of fear, nuance goes out the window. So in the same way as when you're facing that saber-toothed tiger as a caveman human being, you don't want nuance, you want certainty. Saber-toothed tiger, bad, I must survive, thus I'm going to either fight or I'm going to flee. And the same thing happens when you start stoking fears about race or religion or immigration or anything else. When you get people into a really fearful mode, nuance goes out the window. And so instead of looking for complicated, maybe more sensible answers to really deep political issues, a considerable amount of the electorate started looking for certainty, the certainty of the strong man. Didn't matter if the solutions that Trump was proposing were absolute nonsense or would in the long run undermine security. The fact that he said them with such authority and such certainty, and the fact that it was all black and white and there was no nuance, for people who were that insecure, that was what they were looking for. And so that's a long answer to your question, but I think basically we're in this moment where the exploitation of fear and the magnification of fear through things like social media is profoundly shifting our culture and our politics, and in a very dangerous way.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. How do private corporations and the media, even churches and organizations such as NRA, how do they utilize fear to further advance their agendas?
Well, the thing is, fear sells. And it depends what kind of fear. So, I mean, you know, stepping back a bit, there are certain things that corporations have no interest in us fearing. So an example would be when there's a major medical disaster, when a drug is released, a pharmaceutical is released, and it's given to a lot of people and it's promised as a miracle cure for heart disease or whatever it might be. And then it turns out down the road the testing wasn't really very rigorous and there were some red flags that should have been looked at. And in the end, thousands and thousands of people end up dying because they've had heart attacks or strokes or something else. The Vioxx scandal would be a case in point. And there's no interest in the corporate community for us to fear that kind of thing. And so, you know, one of the things I write about in my book is there are some things that hurt a lot of people or kill a lot of people that we don't fear. So medical disasters would be a case in point. Another example, until very, very recently, there really has been no momentum towards gun control, despite the fact that year in, year out, tens of thousands of Americans are killed by guns. And many of those Americans are killed by accident, by guns misfiring, or by children getting control of the guns, and so on and so forth. So there are certain things that we really should be very concerned about, and that we probably should put a lot of emotional and political energy into trying to solve. But there's no momentum to building a national consensus around them. And then there are other things where statistically the chance of something bad happening is really, really small, but we overfear those things because they're salacious or they're sensational or they're easy to visualize. So case in point would be we all fear great white sharks. Or everybody of a certain age fears great white sharks because people my age, when they were growing up, saw the movie Jaws. And it was a great movie, and it was a terrifying movie, and it made us really, really fearful of sharks. It actually turns out that sharks kill far fewer people each year than very run-of-the-mill animals like mosquitoes or ticks. And yet, we're not afraid of ticks. We go on a walk in the forest, and we don't panic that we're about to get a lethal disease. And this fascinates me, this idea that some fears we overfear and some fears we underfear, and sometimes there's a commercial interest in what we fear. Not always, but sometimes.
That makes sense. Now, the U.S. has been at war, constant war, for 17 years. War is almost always associated with emotions of anxiety and stress and even horror. On the one hand, our wars have enabled private defense contractors and intelligence firms to be extremely wealthy. And war and defense makers, they make up the majority of our national budget, 57%. So how have the entities that profit from war employed fear to keep us in a perpetual state of war? And what role has the government had in mind to keep the population in a constant state of anxiety and fear? And doesn't this strategy of fear-mongering actually make our nation more unsafe?
Well, I mean, certainly when you're in a permanent state of panic about certain things and certain people and certain locations, you're more likely to cede personal liberty. So if you fear that terrorism is the single greatest threat facing America, well, at that point, you'll probably make a calculus that says, all right, we've got to cede certain liberties, privacy liberties, for example, in the name of security. Now, there's obviously a reasonable political debate to be had about that balance, you know, because there are threats. You know, only somebody with their head in the sand would look at the modern world and say there are no threats of terrorism. There clearly are threats of terrorism. The question is it the single biggest existential threat facing us? Well, if it's not, but we think it is, we're going to make some pretty unsavory trade-offs in the name of security. Now, you know, obviously it's not a zero-sum game, but to a degree we have a limited emotional bandwidth. So if we're really invested in fearing one thing above all others, we tend to underpay attention to other things. So you mentioned climate change. You know, if somebody was looking at Earth from afar and trying to work out what are the big threats facing human civilization, by any reasonable measure, climate change would rank way up there because it has the capacity to undermine vast numbers of coastal cities, to undermine water supplies, food supplies, and so on. Same thing with nuclear weapons. For an outside observer looking down on Earth, the fact that there are thousands and thousands of nuclear bombs in circulation, and that a few individuals, Putin in Russia, Xi in China, Trump in America, and a few other leaders, have this godly power of destruction vested in them. You know, to an outside observer, that would be a huge, huge issue that we should be spending, you know, vast amounts of our emotional and political and intellectual energies trying to rein in. If we instead say, well, you know, nuclear weapons are out of sight, out of mind, we're, you know, going to hope they're never used and not really pay attention to them, and climate change is this huge, big thing that's probably important, but it's too big to deal with, and thus we're going to focus on something else, and we're going to put all our national security energies into tackling terrorism. Well, you asked, you know, does it make us less safe in the end? It probably does, because ultimately we're putting so many resources into one area of our life that we're putting way too few resources into solving these other huge problems. And you end up way out of balance at the end of the day when that happens. And so we might end up in a situation where transnational terror groups are tamed, and I certainly hope we end up in a situation where these groups are neutered, because they're awful organizations. But we could spend all our energy neutering ISIS and neutering Al-Qaeda, and at the end of the day find we're facing an unlivable planet because of climate change, which we've underinvested in trying to solve. And so, you know, again, when we're calibrating what should we fear, how should we fear things, how should we respond to things we fear, all of that's part of the conversation.
It is, Sasha, but also you have to have people who are reasonable and not manipulative, because at the very time we say we fear terrorists, we are funding terrorists, we are supporting terrorists in different forms, Saudi Arabia. Now we want to give Saudi Arabia the capacity to have nuclear power. I wonder how that would turn out. Sasha, thank you very much for another good book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of American Dream. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Sasha Abramsky, my guest, on a topic that we will continue to focus on. And we're out of time, everyone. And now, that indomitable spirit who's here every day to take you on a journey of insight into the human condition and challenging everything political, Beatrice Lee.
Chicken, chicken.